At this point in history, it's nearly impossible to know what landscapes looked like without people on them. We've been around a long time, and we changed the environment. Good luck finding a place where there's not some change made by people. Trees gone, or different trees planted, or non-native plants moved in. Scientists talk a lot of late about novel ecosystems. Our guest can help us understand the concept and what it means. Patricia Kennedy is a professor at Oregon State University and the director of the Eastern Oregon Agriculture and Natural Resource Program, and she's the lead researcher on a study that looked into whether novel ecosystems provide habitat value for wildlife. One of the two places studied in this round of research is in Eastern Oregon. Patricia Kennedy, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Yes, good morning, Jeff.
So you Google, as I did, novel ecosystem, and you get an avalanche of material, some of it fairly argumentative. What is a novel ecosystem, and why is the concept so hotly debated?
Yes, a novel ecosystem is an ecosystem that has passed some threshold that is likely to not be restored to historic conditions. So we have ecosystems out there that, if you put some money and other resources into it, you could restore them. And these are considered to be ones that have a low probability of being restored. Controversy is there are many people who just view all of these ecosystems as degraded and don't have any value. And that if we think about them as providing habitat for wildlife, that we're just giving up, you know, that we're we're not prioritizing these as areas that need to be restored.
All right. So isn't most of the world novel by this point in human history, though?
Yeah, most of it is, and particularly with climate change coming, it's probably going to be close to all of the globe. But there's still wildlands out there that have very low degrees of novelty. But it's a gradient.
So Patricia, does some of this head in the direction of rewilding, that sort of thing, where people are thinking in terms of fairly heavy-duty restoration?
Oh, that's interesting. Yes, we didn't look at that, but that fits into this. I mean, there are biologists out there who are thinking about trying to put animals out back on the landscape that don't exist anymore, but for which we have their DNA. So it's definitely, this is a big controversy as to how do we manage these changed habitats.
Are there basic divisions like, you know, a camp of only restoration should be sought, or and another camp of novel ecosystems are okay?
Yes, and there's people in the middle. So I think what we tried to do here was to just say these systems, we tried to look at whether or not these systems could provide some habitat. And we're just saying that this novel ecosystems are a tool in the toolbox for conservation, and that some of them probably provide habitat value, and that maybe we need to kind of prioritize what resources we have, and maybe some of these systems don't need a lot of restoration effort.
So for your recent research, you did some comparisons. I mean, what were you looking at? Two different places in the world, for one thing.
Right, and the reason for that is I was on sabbatical in Australia, and I was working with a colleague who had this really great data set. So what we did is we compared the Zumwalt Prairie in northeast Oregon, which is an area that I've worked in for over a decade, which is pretty close. It's as close as you can get to native in a prairie, but it has a lot of non-native pockets of plants. And then he was working on urban gardens in Perth, and we decided to compare these two spots. And the nice thing about this is in Australia, the urban gardens, unlike the ones up here in the U.S., they have almost all native birds. So they're not the birds in the gardens are not non-native like we see here in the U.S., you know, where we have starlings and English sparrows and things like that. So we could look at these two systems and see, okay, ask the question, are they negatively responding to non-native plants?
So, pardon me if this is a dumb question, but
no.
When we talk about urban gardens, are we talking about just gardens scattered throughout the Perth urban area, or is this a specific place called urban gardens?
No, that is a good question. No, it's he sampled 2,000 gardens throughout the Perth area. It was quite a big data set. So, and they varied from just being, you know, a flat lawn of non-native grass to gardens with amazing numbers of native plants, trees, shrubs, and flowers. And so we were able to look at this whole spectrum of systems that had no structure, high novelty to high structure, lots of non-native plants.
That's really interesting, though, that the birds are all generally native. Is that, that's
yes, that is interesting. And I can't, if you're going to ask me why, I can't answer that. But Australia, its gardens, basically these urban gardens are little remnants of native of vegetation that the native species use.
We're talking about novel ecosystems here on the Jefferson Exchange with Patricia Kennedy, a professor at Oregon State University. She is the director of the Eastern Oregon Agriculture and Natural Resource Program based at Eastern Oregon University. Questions, comments from you are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about the Zumwalt Prairie particulars, because you said it's close to native, but there was some heavy human influence, but that is generally passed now. Is that right?
Yeah, except for, you know, the exception is climate change, right? We don't know how that's influencing it. But this has been, this grassland is one of the few large remnants left of a native grassland in North America. It's been a working, so it was used by Native Americans as for horse pasture during the summer. The Nez Perce used it, so it's been grazed for a long time. And then when Euro-Americans came over, we tried to cultivate it, but it wasn't very cultivatable. People couldn't make a living, so they left it as livestock grazing. So it hasn't been plowed, and so a lot of the native plants are still there. It's quite a large acreage of grassland that's left in the U.S.
And then, what about the bird species that have? Because I assume you look bird to birds, right?
Yeah, we did all the bird. Now it's a high elevation grassland, so they don't have lots of species. But the species that are there are of conservation concern, because grassland birds are, as a group, are declining worldwide because we have cultivated grasslands or we live on them. You know, we build houses on them, and so it's a small group of species like western meadowlarks, which are the, you know, the Oregon state bird, and some other species, but they're all native, and it's the same native birds that have been there since we settled it.
So this is not a sage grouse habitat, I'm guessing.
No, that's Great Basin. So this is all grassland. So sage grouse need shrubs, and this is out of the range of sagebrush.
So it sounds like you couldn't hope to duplicate the data set of your colleague in Australia, but then what did you do about picking places to look at how things were living in the ecosystem on the Zumwalt Prairie?
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't think I understood your question.
Well, the data set for Perth is huge, and did you try to get close to that on the Zumwalt Prairie?
Yes, we have a similar data set. So we had been working on the Zumwalt for a long time, looking at questions like how does livestock grazing affect grassland birds? And so we had this big data set as well that was comparable to the Perth data set.
And the measurements sound quite painstaking. I mean, I was looking into the research where you're talking about using lasers and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we had really good data on reproduction for the grassland birds. And then, the Perth data set was just gorgeous. I mean, they really sampled the heck out of Perth. So we're quite happy with that. And they're just two case studies now. We're asking people now to try to apply this stuff to their study areas and see what their results look like.
So if you had to sum up what it was you set out to do, what would that summation be?
We set out to ask the question, do novel ecosystems provide suitable habitat for some native wildlife? And under what conditions do they provide habitat and what conditions do they not? And I think the thing is to not look at all wildlife as not using novel ecosystems. Some do, some don't.
Mm-hmm. All right. I notice you have novel ecosystem avoiders, novel ecosystem utilizers,
right,
and novel ecosystem flourishers. So that's an interesting range of possibilities there.
Right. And so we thought, well, rather than just putting them all into one group, so people who are sort of opposed to this idea just classify novel ecosystems as degraded, right? This degraded habitat, and then we've said, okay, this is too simplistic. There's probably animals out there that use it. There's probably animals that don't, that they disappear. And then there are animals that may just absolutely love novel ecosystems like starlings that just flourish in this kind of habitat, right? So we sort of try to look at this in a less simplistic, more biologically relevant framework.
So it sounds like there are some strains of, if you'll pardon the expression, purity here, where people think in terms of like, no, it's really best to be back to the original system, and that means if you have to chuck out the creatures that live in it now, that's fine.
Right. And we're arguing that probably that might not be appropriate in some cases. It is appropriate. It depends. You know, we're just saying that you should look at this more carefully and not be so dogmatic about it.
Patricia Kennedy, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Again, we're talking about novel ecosystems through a study that really looked at two places, the Zumwalt Prairie in northeastern Oregon and urban gardens in Perth, Western Australia. Patricia is a professor at Oregon State University and the director of the Eastern Oregon Agricultural and Natural Resource Program. Are you developing some thoughts about novel ecosystems and their appropriateness or whether they should be changed? Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about findings. For one thing, I noticed this is set up as a physiognomy versus floristics debate, which is going to require a little hand-holding.
Right. That's the it's typical biological terminology. This just means species. Floristics is species composition, and really what we're focusing on is, does the origin of the plant make any difference, if it's native or non-native? And then physiognomy is the fancy term for structure, how high, how tall, and how dense is the vegetation.
Okay, so it's the what versus the how many or how high.
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
Got it.
Right.
So what were some of the biggest findings you got here from comparing what the findings were in Perth with what you found in the Zumwalt Prairie?
Well, we were able to support our model and that there were groups. There was one species on the grassland that appears to be sensitive to whether or not the native or non-native vegetation is present. So it tends to nest more successfully in native vegetation. And that would be a species we would call a novel ecosystem avoider. And then there was a group of birds in Perth Gardens that were the same thing. These were what they call nectarivores. These are the honey eaters, which is a group of birds that's endemic to Australia. And these birds do much better in high structure and more native vegetation. So a gardener, for example, who wanted to make his or her garden more suitable to native wildlife in Australia would try to plant more native plants. So there was a lot of implications on this towards design of urban gardens in Perth. And we also found species that appeared to just, in native or non-native habitat, they did the same. You know, there was no difference. And these were species we would refer to as utilizers. They're more flexible. You know, they can use it or not.
And then you got the flourishers, too.
We didn't have any of those.
Oh,
so that
okay.
was the limit. We said there's taxa out there. Because we didn't have any non-native birds like starlings or sparrows, English sparrows. But I think in a system where those existed, you would find that they would flourish as the novelty increased. But we just didn't have any in these two systems we looked at.
Were there any particular surprises in what you found in the research? I mean, you've got big data sets in both places now.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine there were a lot of things that jumped out and went, whoa!
Right, that's right. The ahas in science, right? The thing that was a bit surprising is that for some of the species or groups, vegetation, whether it was species or structure, didn't explain the patterns at all. And then we suggested that there probably are other things out there. For example, in the gardens, probably one of the things that might dictate how many birds you've got is whether you've got cats. I think you know Australia, cats are probably the biggest predators on birds. Well, they are. They're the biggest ones in Australia, and they're a big one in the U.S. You know, things that we didn't measure. And then the other thing is a lot of these birds eat insects, and we didn't look at whether or not there were novel insects available or not. You know, so there's a lot of unmeasured stuff that we are suggesting other people look at.
And so where do people take your information now? I mean, on the debate we've already defined over novel ecosystems, where do you think your research ends up? Who does it support?
Yeah, well, I'm hoping we're going to use it to motivate more more people investigating whether or not these novel ecosystems provide habitat, and more importantly, under what conditions do they provide, and where do they not provide habitat? So we're not arguing ignore restoration of systems back to their native state, but just try to figure out where might that be important and where might it be a waste of money.
Is it primarily a money question, or is it also about the appropriateness of habitat for?
Yeah, both. Mm-hmm. Both. I mean, and probably in an ideal world, we'd like to have mostly native habitat, but that's probably not going to be possible under climate change. So historic systems from the Pleistocene are not going to be feasible under a novel climate. And so then the question is, what habitat will work for wildlife under these change systems, and what does require restoration of native plants?
Well, that is a big one, isn't it? You get to the point of saying, well, we could put it back to what it was in, 1900, but then 1900 doesn't really exist here anymore either.
Right. And the other problem we have is that we don't always have a good baseline data set that describes historic conditions. So we want to go back to historic, but we don't really know what that was. So it's really hard to decide what to restore to.
Mm-hmm.
So this way, we're just saying, look at this and see what's providing habitat and what isn't, and then focus the restoration on the novel ecosystems that clearly are not providing habitat. Like you brought up the Great Basin, those cheatgrass monocultures that are taking over sagegrass habitat. Mm-hmm. That's a great example of a novel system that doesn't have any habitat value.
Oh, right. Okay, sure. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Let's take a call from Jeff in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Patricia Kennedy as we talk about novel ecosystems.
Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Yeah, you were just talking about the cheatgrass in eastern Oregon. I was wondering if, for example, where juniper has taken over what used to maybe be sagebrush or grassland, and where sagebrush maybe has taken over what used to be bunch grass, grasslands, if those would be considered novel ecosystems, because those are native species. They've just increased in some areas, decreased in others.
Right. That is a great question, Jeff. It probably wouldn't be considered. It's a good question. It's novel from the standpoint that it wasn't there in the, the turn of the 1700s, 1600s. But you're right. It's a change in the native composition. But in this system that in this sort of concept that we're looking at, it clearly is going to provide habitat for different species than the sagebrush does, right? So we're going to lose some species and gain other species that like trees, that like woodlands. And probably this will be, juniper will provide, it provides native habitat for some group of native species, but then we're losing the other ones. And this is a really sticky problem. What do we do with invasive native plants?
Right. And I just imagine that the overall complexity, they were trying to pull apart the parts of an ecosystem that has become something of itself. It is a novel ecosystem, but it exists now.
It does. And it could, it's a great question, what would I classify the juniper invasion? Because it's one of those systems where it's really hard to restore. It takes a lot of effort to try to get that back to its native sagebrush. But juniper does provide wildlife habitat for native wildlife, but it doesn't provide habitat for things like sage grouse that are on the endangered species list. So that's a really very complex question.
Jeff, thanks for the question, and
question.
Thanks to Patricia Kennedy for joining us today in the exchange. If you're looking for the research, it's called "Do Novel Ecosystems Provide Habitat Value for Wildlife?" Revisiting the physiognomy versus floristics debate. It's on the March 25th. Issue of Ecosphere, the Journal of the Ecological Society of America. Dr. Kennedy, thanks for joining us today on the exchange.
Great. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Take care.